Tonight we have our founder, Clarence Snyder.
Well, I'm called all kinds of things. Sometimes it's complimentary. Well, thanks, Dick. And this is wonderful to look over this sea of smiling faces here tonight. And I'm very happy to find so many people out here at our first retreat here at this place. And we're going to stay here. We're going to have two a year here. We'll have the next one in March. And you'll all get flyers when advising you when the date is and so forth. And let me say this. When you do, get your reservation in a hurry for this reason. We don't have as many beds available in March as we'd like to have. And so the first ones to get in, they are the ones that are going to get it. So remember that. Why, as you heard, my name is Clarence Snyder, and I happen to be the oldest man in the world. That's what they asked Grace some years ago, if she'd like to meet the oldest man in the world. And she was looking for some fellow in a wheelchair with a hot water bottle on his lap and a blanket over that and a nurse in attendance. And so she got quite a shock when she saw this one come bouncing out of the hotel without the wheelchair. But I am the last one living of the original people who set this program up and wrote the book. When Dick was talking about founding AA, there's a lot of talk about how AA started, and there's a lot of mythology about it. Let me tell you how it all started so you can understand this. When I came to this fellowship, it was not known as Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the Oxford Movement, and there was no AA. Doc Smith, my sponsor, was in the Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio, and Bill Wilson belonged to the Oxford Group at Calvary House in New York. And the Oxford Group was not a group organized for alcoholics. They were civilians, earth people. And they invited some of these alcoholics in, and more or less as a challenge. They had a program of what they call a life-changing program, and they felt that anyone who would accept this program could get his life changed no matter what kind of a sinner he was. And, of course, alcoholics were not looked upon as sick people in those days. They were looked upon as despicable sinners, if you can call it that. We were the worst of the lot. And so we were rather a challenge to these good Christian people. And believe me, when they start fooling around with alcoholics, we nearly screwed the place up for them. But I came in, and most of the people in the Oxford Movement, as I say, were civilians, and we were a minority. I attended Oxford Group meetings for 15 months in Akron, Ohio, and eventually we started a AA group in Cleveland, Ohio in May of 1939. And the reason for that is this, and you don't read this in AA literature, but here's the scoop. The Oxford Movement was a religious movement. It was a Protestant religious fellowship and organization. And no Catholics were in it for the simple reason that a Catholic church would not permit their members to belong to the Oxford Movement for various reasons, because of some of the rigmarole that the Oxford Group members went through, such as open confession, which we used to call witnessing, and also we would get guidance for other people. And some of these Oxford Group people, there were degrees of surrender in the Oxford Movement. So there were surrendered people, and there were the more surrendered. The more surrendered had a direct wire to God. They plugged right in and got all the answers for everybody else. And, of course, the Catholic Church didn't care too much about these kind of shenanigans as for their members. So there weren't any in there. Well, what happened is this. I was on the bum. I wound up a complete bum. And in so doing, I wound up in New York City. The way I got there, I belonged to a family, I was married into a very clannish family. This family originated togetherness. They did everything together in my house. And there was always two, three, or four, or five of them at my home at any given time. You could always find a crowd there. And this gang used to have family conferences. And I was never invited to the conferences because I was generally the subject under discussion. The discussions went along the line as whether they're going to throw me out again or let me back in again. I was in and out of that house like a yo-yo. So finally, they got a real bright idea, as some civilians do, when they're dealing with alcoholics. I'd been between jobs for a couple of years, and they were very much interested in my getting on the ball and getting an income arranged. And so since it never worked out too well, or didn't work out at all for that matter, I had other things to do, more important than making a living. So they decided that they were going to give me one more chance to stay home. And this was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for my wife's brother. This isn't this wife. This is my wife, Dorothy. You'll read a lot about Dorothy in that book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. That was Dorothy in that clarinet you see running around through that book. That happened to be me. And so this boy had a truck, big outfit. And he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York and back. And they decided that I should become his helper. Now this would do two things. It would give me gainful employment, and it also would keep me sober because he'd see to it that I didn't get out and get drunk. He was going to be a policeman besides that. And I was going to be living in close proximity to him. Well, this was a great idea. I mean, the logic is good, but don't ever try to mess around with the logic when it comes to alcoholics. You really go down the drain. Alcoholics have no logic, no common sense. And when people start dealing with us in that vein, they're bound to have come to utter failure. So I had to go along with this deal. I was not in favor of it, let me say this. For two reasons. First of all, it smacked of hard work. And I've always been against hard work. And I still am. I think work is a disgrace. It's a dirty word. And the second thing, I've never been on a truck in my life. And the idea of getting up in this thing, in this big cab, and getting to even drive this thing or think about getting my hand on this wheel, it was forbidden, really. Well, this was some, I suppose, 45, 48 years ago. And you know, to this day, I've never had my hands on the wheel of that truck yet. Because I got away from him in Albany, New York. And this is my first chance to get away from this guy. He finally conked out. See, we had a sleeper cab. He'd sleep on the seat, and I was supposed to sleep by the little window up in the back. And he drove, and he drove, and he drove. He drove all night and all next day until the following evening, and we got to Albany, and he was bushed. So he pulled the rig over to the curb and said he's going to take a nap for a few hours. I said, good. We're in Albany, New York. I always wanted, and it's the capital of New York. And I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. This is my first chance to get away from him. He didn't know it, but I had a dollar in some sense on my person, which he didn't know about. We always have that ace of the hole, you know. And I beat it down. I can still remember. It's a funny thing, some of these things you remember. I beat it down to the street to the first watering hole I saw, and I went in there, and I went right out again because I could see at the first glance that this place was too rich for my blood, with a dollar and something in my pocket. That isn't enough to start in a place like that. So I went down a few blocks, and I got into a place that was more suitable to a man of my estate. This is a real joint. And I got in there, and I got started, and as we are wont to do, I met an angel. I prefer to think he was a fairy, but I think he was I call him an angel. Because he had some big ideas, and he was very generous, and he was pouring drinks in me as fast as I would lap them up. Finally, when things got a little uncomfortable, time to leave, I went in the men's room, locked the door, and went out the window, and away I went back to the truck. I suppose he's still waiting for me. But I went back to this truck, and this brother-in-law of mine is sleeping peacefully on that seat. And in my effort to get back up into my nest up there, I stepped on this poor boy's face. And awkward I was, you know. See, I hadn't had a drink for 2 days, and this had been a record for me, because I couldn't get away from him 2 days. And I took all these drinks, and they probably all hit me at once on the way back to this truck. And boy, when I landed in there, of course, and stepped on this guy, he came awake with a start. And he knew church, and the church was out. And, you know, there was a disaster. But he carried me on into New York, and he threw me out there and left me. And he told me, don't ever come home. This is the end of the line for you, period. So there I was. This was the beginning of winter. I didn't have any clothes, no overcoat, anything like that. That anything saleable had been sold. You wonder why I always change clothes all the time. I have a fetish. Some of the stuff that I used to wear, I had no clothes. Now that I'm sober, I buy clothes, and I like them. I buy them, borrow them, or steal them, or what. I have clothes anyway. Well, anyway, I'm in New York. I'm out of money now. And I knew only one family in Greater New York City. Another one of his sisters, and she lived in Yonkers. And I figured Virginia owed me something, and she sure did. By all rights, that's right and holy, she certainly was in my debt, but I don't want to go into that. So I figured I'd get out to see Virginia, and she'd do something for me. But of course I was wrong. I made my way out there, and Virginia lived up on a hill in Yonkers, way up there. I remember this because we had been there on our honeymoon. As I say, we did everything together in that family. I got up to, instead of going up on a hill, I went down the hill. And that's where all the Italians live. And the Italian people, now this is way back in bootleg days, remember this. Italians all have wine. Most of them make it. Most of them drink it. Some of them sell it, and some of them share it with their friends. So I went down and made friends. And when I got up to Virginia's house, I was a holy mess. I don't remember too much about that trip to Virginia's house and that visit, except that I was rolling around on the floor with her two little girls. They were just little babies, 2 or 3 years old. And I'm drunk, and I'm dirty, and I smell bad. So Virginia takes a dim view of this performance. She put me in her car and took me back down to the waterfront where her brother had thrown me out, and she did likewise. They're always riding me, these people taking me someplace. Well, I was there, and I was without funds, of course, and I didn't have any backing. I don't know anyone in New York. There's 7 or 8 million people coming and going in New York every day, and I had to exist. And I did, for a long time. That's another story. But someone asked me today how I got here, and I'm trying to show you how I arrived here, because I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. And only a rummy can do that. So, after Virginia dumped me down there, I had to get along, which I did, but of course, time went on. She wrote Dorothy, my wife, about this visit. Well, sometime later, Virginia, the sister-in-law, had her doctor over there. I don't know if I infected the kids or what, but she had the doctor over there anyway. And he was a family friend. That's when doctors made house calls. So you know how long ago that was. So she told him about the visit of her brother-in-law, and what a nice guy he used to be, her favorite brother-in-law, and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum he is now. And this doctor says, you know, that's odd. He says, I had a brother-in-law who was a lush, and he met some strange cult of people here in New York. And since he's met this cult, he don't drink anymore. And he runs all over New York trying to fix drunks. And he brings them home and they smash up his furniture and stuff like that. He don't have much luck with them, but he's at least he's not drinking anymore. And he said there's another medical doctor in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Robert Smith, who belongs to this strange cult in Akron, Ohio. And if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and meet this doctor, and this doctor can fix him. We used to call it fixing. So, of course, I don't know this is going on. This is another thing. These people are always doing things behind my back. And so Virginia wrote Dorothy about this doctor and all this sort of thing. So eventually I get the homing instinct, like I guess everyone does. I wanted to go home. I don't know why. There wasn't anything great to go home to, but you want to go home. So I got home, and one trucker took me to Erie, another one took me to the outskirts of Cleveland where I lived. It was the middle of winter. I charged up on the front porch and pounded on the door, and Dorothy came to the door and opened it, but she did not unhook the screen. And these screens were up in the middle of winter. I thought that was something. And I used that as part of my persuasion, that argument. I was trying to get in the house, and she wasn't about to let me in. So I pointed out to her that people don't leave screen doors and screens up all winter. That she needed a man around the house to take care of these details. And she allowed us how she needed a man around the house, but she didn't need one that badly. So that didn't work. But she had gotten this letter from Virginia. Virginia wrote about this doctor in Akron. And Dorothy asked me if I would like to meet him. Well, I had absolutely nothing to lose. So I said, sure. Of course, I can transact my business in Akron as well as I can in Cleveland. So she put me in her car. Again, they're writing me. And took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and put me on the bus and gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and that sent me on my way. And that's how I met my sponsor, who eventually put me in Akron City Hospital. That's how I came to this thing. There was no AA. When I came out of that hospital, Doc Smith took me to a meeting of the Oxford group that night at the home of T. Henry and Clarissa Williams. Let me tell you what happened to me in the hospital. I'm a fundamentalist in AA. I stay by the book, and I stay by the way I was taught. And I don't know why I shouldn't. I've been sober longer than anybody in the world in AA, so it should lend some credence or some authority to what I say. A lot of people can tell me all about how to do this thing, but a lot of them are in and out and up and down and having a rough time, some of them. But I know what I'm talking about. I know what worked for me. And here's what happened. Doc took me in this hospital. I didn't go in the first time that I met him because he scared me and I ran out on him. But I did call him finally, and he told me to come down, and he told me to meet him at Akron City Hospital in the morning. And I was there. And I didn't have enough money for car fare when I got down to Akron. I got enough for the bus fare, but I had to walk out to this city hospital. And this is the middle of winter. This is in February again. And Akron is known as the city of seven hills. And they don't have any downhills. They're all up. And I walked up these hills out to Akron City Hospital, which was an awful long ways, so it seemed to me anyway. And I didn't have an overcoat, and I'm sweating, perspiring when I got out there. I think it was weakness more than anything else. As I went into the lobby of this hospital, and that's all I remember. I fainted. I conked out, landed on the floor. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't falling down drunk. I didn't know why I fainted. I was just weak. When I woke up, I'm up in a room, and seemed to be the center of attraction here. There's all kinds of people with white uniforms around me, and they're giving me a bath of all things. Why are they doing this? So they're giving me a bath. When I opened my eyes, believe me, the first thing I saw sitting on that windowsill there was a bottle of rub. And I was always scared to death of DTs. I never had them. But some of my buddies did, and I've seen people die with them. And this was a frightening situation as far as I was concerned. I was scared to death of DTs. But I never had them. I never gave them a chance. You only get DTs when you're getting cut off from your intake. And I never allowed that to happen. So I saw that rub on that windowsill, and here's my ace in the hole. It gives me courage. So the first thing I know, a nurse comes in with a tray, and she has on it a big shot of rather whitish substance and a big hooker of booze. And she says, "Mr. Snyder, we have some medicine for you. You drink this medicine, this colorless stuff, and wash it down with this nice whiskey." Well, I look at that. I'm looking at that jug on the windowsill, and I get on my muscle. And I told her a thing or three. I came down here to quit drinking, and I'll thank you to take that stuff out of here. Oh, that was the worst thing I ever did. I'd been drunk for some years. I was not a periodic. I was drunk all the time. No, people didn't even know I was drunk most of the time. This is my normal way of being. And she took it away. But you know, I never touched that booze on that windowsill. I figured there'd be a bottle in every room, too. They were pretty stupid about things in those days. They hadn't had the experience with rummies yet. But I never touched it. So the last drink I had in my life was February 11, 1938. But I'll tell you one thing. Don't you give me any talk about how you suffered about drinking. If you've been drunk as long as I was and quit like that without any tapering off drinks, brother, you get the shakes. You get the shivers, you get the sweats, you get goose pimples. I had spider webs all over my body. I'll never forget that. But, so what happened? After I'm in there a couple of days, they didn't give me any tapering off. They didn't give me anything. The hard way, kid. I couldn't eat. So after a couple of days, the men, the alcoholics in the Oxford group, came in to see me. And there was about a dozen of them. And they were all much older men than I was. I was only 35 years old then. And these men were 10, 15, 20 years older than me. And boy, they'd been down that road. And they came in and told me their stories. And boy, those fellas gave me a lift. When I listened to those men, the power of example of those men did something for me. And I wanted what they had. They were laughing. Believe me, it's been a long time since I had anything to laugh about. But these fellows are none of them sober very long, just matters of weeks and months. Doc was sober a little over a year. He was a veteran there. So there wasn't much sobriety among them, but they were sober, they were dry, and they were having fun. And they inspired me. And here's what they did. Every man told me his story. And as he left, he told me that he had the answer to my drinking problem, and then he left on that note. He didn't tell me what the answer was. Every one of them did the same thing. So I'm laying there wondering what's going to happen to me. I was looking for some kind of an operation. See, Doc was a surgeon, and it struck me rather odd. He was a rectal surgeon. And he's fixing drunks. Of course, I did feel that this was rather a new approach to the problem. But these men talked to me he came in every afternoon and sat on the foot of my bed, a very unprofessional posture, but he always did. And I was scared of this guy. I don't want to go into a long story why I was, but I was frightened to death of this man, really was. And if any of you knew Doc Smith, he was 6'4", thin, angular, and he was a Vermont Yankee, and he was a man of few words, and they were very forceful words. And Doc had fingers on him this long, which I presume helped him in his profession. But he used to point these fingers at me, he used to poke me in the chest. If there's anything I don't like, it's some bird poking me in the chest. But to lend emphasis to things, this is what he used to do, poke holes on me. Well, anyway, The last day I'm in there, Doc came in and looked at me. And I'm scared of this fellow. He says, well, young fellow, he called me young fellow. He had a name for everyone. I don't think he even knew these guys' names. He handed a name, a moniker, to every guy around there. But I was young fellow because I was the youngest one. Didn't have any of these young ones before. He says, what do you all think of this by this time? I says, well, Doc, I think this is great. These men come in to see me. They tell me the story of their life and what happened to them through booze. But I'm puzzled about one thing. He says, what's that? I says, these men all tell me they have the answer to my drinking problem, but then they leave. They don't tell me the answer. Now, I've been here about a week, and I'm supposed to be leaving here. What happens now? What are you going to do to me? What's this answer? Boy, did he ever throw me a curve. He says, we don't know about you, young fella. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any luck with these young fellas. They're all screwballs. Well, I wasn't the one to argue that. So I said, well, that's why I'm here. I want to quit. And I finally had to convince him. He says, well, I don't know if you're ready for this yet. Ready for it? I weighed 130 pounds. I'm 5'11". I didn't have any more home than a rabbit. I had no money. I had no clothes. I didn't know where I was going when I left that hospital. Right? And I was washed out. I was done. Ready. I don't know what you have to be ready. So I guess I finally convinced him I was. He says, okay, young fellow, I'll give you the answer to this thing. Now, here's the way I was presented this program. He turned around. He pointed that big finger at me. He says, young fellow, he says, do you believe in God? Gee, this shocked me. Believe in God. I went down there for medical help. I wasn't about to worry about God. And what's a doctor talking about God for? So, boy, I had to avoid this question. This is ridiculous. So the best thing I can come up with is, well, what does that have to do with it? I thought that was pretty smart. He says, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Now I know I'm in trouble. If I don't go around along with this bird, I'm liable not to get fixed. So the next bright one I come up with is this. Well, I guess I do. So there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. Now, this is how to give the spiritual foundation of AA to a new person. Don't you forget this. People wonder why I'm screwy on this deal. This is the way I got it. Now I am in trouble. Unless I go along with this dodo, I'm not going to get fixed at all. So whether I believed it or not, I said yes. I do believe in God. He said, fine, young fellow. Now we can get someplace. He says, get down out of that bed. I says, for what? He says, get down on your knees. I says, for what? You know, that shorty nightgown? Bare bones on that concrete floor in a shorty nightgown. I should get on my knees with this rectal surgeon. I says, for why? He says, we're going to pray. I said, who's going to pray? He said, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do, but you get down there and I'll pray and you can repeat after me. That'll do for this time. So he hauls me out of there and he uttered a prayer and I repeated it. I don't remember what it was, but I have a pretty good idea. But I do remember this, that after he concluded his prayer, he shook hands with me. He said, young fellow, you're going to be all right. And that night he carried me to this meeting of the Oxford group. That's how I started in AA. When I left that Oxford group meeting that night, I got one of the surprises of my life. While I was in that hospital, he had contacted Dorothy, and he sold her the idea, giving me another chance at home for a while. And she fell for it. She came to that meeting. So I went home with her. I had no idea where I was going to leave, where I was going when I left that hospital. Now, that's an act of God that happened, because that whole family was strictly down on me. So he persuaded her to take me back, which she did. She kept me there for about a year, and she threw me out again, sober. But nevertheless, it worked while I was while I really needed it. Well, that's how I was introduced to this program. Then when I left to go back to Cleveland, Doc told me this, and I shall never forget it. He said, you go back to Cleveland. See, there was no group or anything like that there, nothing. No book, no literature, nobody, just me. So you go back to Cleveland and you spend the rest of your life fixing rummies as an avocation. Somebody here last night asked me, well, why I call them rummies. That's all we knew to call them. Everybody's rummies in those days. When they start calling me an alcoholic, I thought I got advanced. I was elevated. But everybody was a rummy in those days. Well, anyway, he told me that was I supposed to spend the rest of my life as an avocation. And for going on to 44 years, that's what I have done. I'm still doing it. And it pays dividends. So you see, I didn't have any choice as to what I was going to do. The choice, I run out of choices. And any person who's ready for AA, I don't care what your financial status or your social status or what have you is, if you're ready for this, you have run out of choices. And this is the hardest thing for some people to learn when they come to AA, because they like to hold reservations. You present a program to a person's hair, and they want to take it cafeteria style. I remember when Gracie came into the fellowship, she came in Jacksonville. I was not her sponsor. She had an Al-Anon sponsor. She had the drunk that was supposed to sponsor her didn't know any more about this program than she did, and she knew nothing. But her Al-Anon sponsor helped her in many respects. At least she kept most of the wolves off of her while she was getting her feet on the ground, which was a big help. But sponsorship is very important, and I have learned something about it and how there's a way to bring people to this. When she came in, she got the regular crap that a lot of people get when they come to AA. They apologized for the program. So her sponsor told her, well, you don't have to do this and that. Take what you like out of this program, throw the rest of it out the window. That's what they told her when she came to AA. Well, kids, if you want to throw any of it out the window, you better go out the window with it, because that's about how much good it's going to do you. This program is complete, and if any person wants to recover, you want to remember you've lost your choices, and you're going to do it or you're not. I always say there's four ways of doing things. There's a poor way, there's a fair way, there's a good way, and there's an excellent way. And alcoholics, by nature, are extremists, and we never do anything by halfway measures in our career. And if we're going to clean it up, we better do it the whole way also. And then we'll get great joy out of this. A lot of people don't agree with these things because they still want to run things of hold reservations. Our book tells us there are no such things as holding reservations. It's whole hog or nothing. It says in our fifth chapter, half measures avail us nothing. It does not say that half measures avail us half results. It says nothing. Avail us nothing. That ought to be a real lesson to us. All right. When I came to this fellowship, we had six steps. The Oxford Movement. We got all of our program out of the Oxford Movement. This program that we have is not peculiar to AA. We just took the six steps of the Oxford Movement and made 12 steps out of them. We probably figured if alcoholics could screw up six steps, they could screw up 12 much easier. They could give them a wider range. And they do. Well, anyway, our whole program, you will find, comes from the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to read it in full and study it, get the 5th, 6th, 7th chapter of Matthew. And the book of James. The book of James is a healing ministry. And also the theme of that is faith without works is dead. But this is where our program came from. So when you tell some people that, oh, you're talking religion. I'm not talking religion, I'm talking a program. Where do you think this program came from? You know, alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. You can read about alcoholism in ancient history. You can read about it in mythology, and you can read about it in the Bible. So it's been with us a long, long time. There's some terrific rummy stories in the Bible. See, we were talking about one today. Some of us were sitting around talking about rummies in the Bible. Somebody was mentioning Noah. I said, boy, old Noah, he was a rummy. Oh, you bet you boots he was a rummy. We have a Moses in here. I don't know about Moses. But Noah, you know, if you want to read about rummies, you can go to the first book of the Bible in Genesis. Read about Noah and his ark. Just figure it out. What happened? How do I know this guy's a rummy? He's one of us. Here's a reason. The world has got itself in such a shape about the way it is now. Everything's going downhill, and people are hell-bent for disaster, you know? And God did everything he could to try to get these monkeys to straighten up. And he finally figured, what's the use? I'll just flood the thing and drown them all and start all over again. Which is probably a good way of doing things, you know? We do that in business sometimes. But he wanted some seed to start again with. So old Noah was a God-fearing man. So he goes to Noah. He says, Noah, my boy, you should do something for me. He says, yes, Lord, anything. See, Noah's obedient. So he told him what he's going to do. He says, I'm going to flood this whole world and everything living in it, but I need seed. And I want you and your family, there's seven of you in that family, I want you to survive. And I want you to build a big boat. And I want you in that boat to put two of everything living, every kind of animal and bird and the whole thing, so they can reproduce. Because I'm going to wipe this whole thing out and start new. Yes, sir. So, guess you, Lord, I'll do that. So Noah and his family get out there, cutting logs, making boards, pounding, building. For 140 years, they're making this yacht, this ark. And the neighbors come by, and they look at Noah. So what are you doing, Noah? I'm building a boat. You're building a boat out in the middle of a desert? Old Noah had flipped. See, they think his shingles are going off the roof, building a boat out in the desert. But he didn't bother with all their criticism. He kept right on going. And you get your criticism for building boats here, too, kids. So don't forget it. So they kept on. And finally the thing was completed and loaded up. And the rains came, boy. And they rained and it rained and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And that old ark came up and up and up and started floating around. It floated for several months. And finally the waters began to recede and that old ark landed on Mount Ararat. And the water went down and the ground came up. And what was the first thing our friend Noah did? He ran out there and planted a vineyard. He raised some grapes. He made some wine. And he got drunk. Now, you can't tell me he wasn't planning all this. He was one of us. That's the first one of us that we have record of, see? Oh, there's some other ones there. There's some other ones in the Bible. Dandy. Someone mentioned one today. They're talking about the prodigal son. Somebody screwed that story up on our TV the other night. I listened to some preacher trying to explain the prodigal son story. He met himself coming back. For a simple reason, he didn't know that's a drunk story. But he didn't know that. So he's trying to attach some other meaning to it. This is strictly a drunk story. What happened? Here's these two boys. These two kids, brothers, the older one and the younger one, and they're working for their father. And their father is a very wealthy farmer. He has a big spread, and they're Jewish people. Don't keep this in mind. He's a Jewish. So these two kids are working for their father and doing what they're supposed to be doing. But the one guy, he's doing more than he should be doing. The older boy, he's a worker. He's the Al-Anon kid. He's doing what good Al-Anon should do. This other guy, the younger one, guess who? He is not satisfied to work for his father, and he gets out as much of this work as he can. And he's always bugging his father for his share of the loot. When the father dies, the two boys are supposed to divvy up the estate. And they have a big spread there. He has a lot of cows and a lot of sheep and a lot of grain, no hogs. But everything else they have there, see? And they're working out there, and finally this kid's bugging his dad and bugging his father for his share of the loot. And the father can't stand it anymore. He gets sick of the whole thing. So he says, okay, you take your share and be gone with it. And boy, that's all this kid wanted to hear. Because he wanted his money when he's young so he could go out and enjoy it, see? So he takes his share. And what does it say in the Bible he did? He went into a far country and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear a thing like that? Did you ever hear of anyone doing that? He blew the whole bundle on wine, women, and song. Very little singing. So he's tapped out, broke. And remember, he's in a far country, away from home. And what happened? The worst is yet to come, kids. A famine set in. He's broke, and he can't get a job, and he can't get anything to eat. He's a stranger out there, and nobody wants him around. They've got their own problems without fooling with him. So the only thing he finally wound up doing, he got a job on a hog farm, if you please. This Jewish kid, tending a bunch of hogs. This is something. I would say this kid's on the way down, wouldn't you? So finally, what happened? Did he eat what the hogs ate? Nope. It says in the Bible he ate of the husks of the hogs. He ate what the hogs wouldn't eat and what they left over. So that's what he got to eat. Now, what it said last night here, it says he came to himself. He came to himself. Bill Makepeace said this last night. And that's what you and I had to do. And he said something. He says, I starve. My father has much and his servants eat well and I'm starving. Now here's what he said, and you and I had to do the same blooming thing. He says, I will arise and go to my father, and I will tell him I am unworthy, see? And I will be his servant. Boy, that's what we had to do. We got down to that end. We got hit our extremity. So we hollered to our father for help. So this kid starts on that long, arduous trip back home. And he's broke, he's sick, he's hungry, he's defeated. So he heads for home, and what happened? Did his father chew him out? Nope. It says in the Bible that the father saw him afar off, and he ran to his son, and he fell on his neck and kissed him. He says, my son who is dead is alive. He says, let us make merry, put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet, a cloak on his back. Let us have a party. Let us celebrate. My son who is dead is alive. So he took the kid up to the house, and they had a real blast up there. Boy, they were having a party. They're singing and dancing and having a big old time. Meanwhile, this Al-Anon kid, he's still out there working away, like a good Al-Anon should. And he hears this ruckus up at the house, but he keeps on with his duties, and finally a servant comes by and says, hey, what's going on at the house? What's all that noise up there, that music and all that? He says, haven't you heard? He says, no, what? He says, well, your brother came home. He says, oi, that dirty no good. So then he drops his tools and goes up and confronts his father. And that is a real human thing. He says to his father, he says, you're having a party, this no good brother of mine goes out and blows everything he has on wine, women, and song. And he comes back here, broke, and you have a party for him. He says, I work all the time for you, and I never disappointed you. You never gave me a party, Dad. Now, see? Well, his father had explained why this was. It's a great story of forgiveness, your father's forgiveness, the second chance. You and I have had the same thing. We're in the same position, and gives us that second chance. Oh, that's just one of the other stories. I got. There's a lot of good stories in the Bible. You want to hear about the first 12-step call? The first 12-step call on record. The story of the Good Samaritan. Wow, here's a story. They're all rummies in this one. Here's this joker, this drunk. He's lying beside the road, naked. He's lost everything he had. He's laying there all beat up and he's half dead. Well, along comes a priest and he sees him. Well, you know what's happened to this guy, don't you? He got drunk and he got rolled. I don't know if any of you ever got rolled, but this guy made it. So he's lying there, and this priest comes along. He's a man of the world. He's seen these drunks before in all this kind of this situation. And he says to himself, says he, good enough for this dirty, stinking, drunken bum. He got himself in that shape. Let him get himself out of it as best he can. And he crossed over on the side of the road and let the poor slob lying there, see? This happens yet today, you know. So the next fella comes along, this Levite, and he's man of the world, and he sees this fella lying there, and says the same thing. He got himself in that shape, let him get himself out of it. I will not get involved. And he crosses over and leaves this poor slob lying there in his misery. But then the third guy comes along, this Samaritan, and they were not exactly the chosen people around there in those days, but this guy was a traveling salesman. Oh yeah, I'll prove it. And he came by and he saw that guy lying there. This traveling salesman likewise was a rummy. And he sees this bird and recognized him immediately. But he did not cross on the other side. He got down off of his former conveyance. It was not a Chevrolet, it was probably a mule. And he ministered to him. Now what does it say in the Bible that he gave him? It tells you plainly, he gave him wine. He poured it in him, and he poured it in his wounds, too. So he got him alive with this wine, and he bathed his wounds. He didn't leave him lie there, either. He picked him up, and he put him on his form of conveyance, and he took him to the Holiday Inn. It says it took him to an inn. And here's how I know they're all rummies, and I know he's a salesman. He says to this innkeeper, he says, Mr. Innkeeper, take care of this fella. Here is some money. You see, he gave the money to the innkeeper, not the drunk. He knew. He was one of them. He knew. He said, you take care of him. Here's how I know he's a salesman making that territory. He says, if there be any more due, I will repay you on my next visit through here. So he's a salesman making that territory. Very simple. That's the first 12-step call on record, and it's in the Bible, the New Testament. So we've been doing these things a long time, kids. Well, now, here's what happened to this program. When I came here, we had 6 steps, which amount to the same thing we have now, as I say. And the Oxford movement called this a life-changing program. People who wanted to get their lives changed and regulated come into this program and accept the program, apply it to their lives, and go out and do service to the Lord, and their lives changed. So that's what I was taught. And I stayed in the Oxford movement for 15 months, till finally we had to break away from them because of religion, as I mentioned before. Out of the first dozen men who went down to Akron from Cleveland, 7 of them were Catholics. The first boy I ever sold this idea to. Now, it kills me when I listen to a lot of this crap in AA today about attraction and all this crap. Who wants to get attracted to a bunch of drunks anyway? This is a promotion. It's a sales job. You're selling the greatest thing there is. There was nothing to be attracted to when I came in this thing. I was the only guy in Cleveland. And I had to go out and sell this idea to a bunch of drunks. There was no shortage of drunks, I'll warrant you that, in the Depression days. But I'd nail some drunk coming down the street. I'd tell him, hey, you ought to quit drinking. You ought to be like me. You can imagine the reception I got. Yeah, this is a fact. Then I had to go out and contact all kinds of sources. I went to ministers, I went to churches, I went to social agencies, I went to all these service clubs. Any place that had anything to do with rummies, I went and told them that I'd fix their rummies if they had them. They'd take their cares away. It took me 7 months, and after talking to hundreds of assorted drunks, dipsomaniacs, and alcoholics, and what have you, before I sold my first guy. And the first fella I sold this idea to was a Polish fella. He had been an auditor for Sherwin Williams Paint Company in Cleveland and been on the bum for some years and hadn't seen his family for 4 or 5 years. And this was the first guy, I'll never forget this man if I live to be 1,000. I was looking for drunks. And in those days, some of you people who have gray hair or no hair can remember these days back in the 30s when the Depression was on and a lot of people lost their homes. And a lot of vacant houses were sitting around because a lot of people had to double up for survival. And a lot of drunks would just go in and take squatters' rights in some of these houses, and they'd go in there to keep out of the weather. And I wandered into one of these places way over on Fleet Avenue, and way over to the south end of Cleveland, over in a Polish neighborhood. And here's a bunch of drunks lying around in there. And this one big guy, he's a big fella, he was lying on the floor there, and he was motionless. But he was conscious. This is something. The guy knew everything I said, and he could speak, but he couldn't move a finger. He was what you call paralyzed drunk. And I tried to make my pitch to all these drunks in there, which, of course, they don't listen to. They're too busy carrying on their activities. And I got down on the floor with old Bill Hess, and I asked him how he'd like to quit drinking. And he was all for it. I had a captive audience. He couldn't get away. Well, I got some of those jug heads to help me pick him up, and I was going to take him, then I changed my mind. I finally asked him the next silly question. I asked him if he could get a hold of 50 bucks. I might as well ask him for $1 million, you know. He couldn't get a hold of 15 cents. But he told me his mother, out in Madison, Ohio, which is 55 miles east of Cleveland, she had a farm out there, and if I went out to see her and told her that I had him in tow, she hadn't seen him in years, she would probably come out with the dough. So that's all I needed. I had a prospect, my first prospect in 7 months. So I got in the jitney, and away I went for Madison, Ohio, and I left Bill lying there. I figured that's the best thing. And I went to Madison, Ohio, and found this farm, way back on a lane, and I got back there after much difficulty and pounded on the door, and this little old lady came to the door, and Bill forgot to tell me one thing. His mother was Polish and she did not speak one word of English. And I'm 55 miles away from home, going to try to chisel this old gal out of 50 bucks. Well, you know, rummies can do anything. Nothing can stop us. A little kid there, one of the grandchildren, about 7 or 8 years old, through him as an interpreter, I talked this old biddy out of 50 bucks. And she went in and cut a lump out of the mattress, because people weren't using banks in those days. They were all closed. And she brought 50 of these great big bills, those old bills that they used to have. Some of you can remember them. They were about twice the size of the bills we have today. And she gave me this 50 bucks. And boy, that's all I needed. I got in that jitney and way back I went, and Bill's still lying where I left him after all these hours. So I got these jug heads to help me, and I called Doc Smith and told him I'm bringing a baby down to the hospital. So he met me down there, and that was my first victory. The first person I ever sold this idea to. Something happened, because, you know, in our steps, in our program, it tells us that we have something to give away. I didn't have anything up to that time. I had no program. I had a lot of time, a lot of brass, and a lot of ignorance, and I went around trying to spread this around among drunks. And I hadn't have anything to offer, but I finally got something to offer. I got a program to sell. I had something. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, I had something, but it took me 7 months to get a program that I could sell. After that, they came in real fast, and that was the beginnings of AA. Well, I don't know why I got onto that end of it. I wanted to talk about this program because so many people have asked me to today. I have a peculiar way to a lot of people of introducing people to AA. I think it's a shame the way people are pushed around and done nothing for in AA. They come here, and we have the greatest thing there is in the world. This alcoholism is such an old malady, and up to about 40-some years ago, the alcoholic had no chance whatever. I have a big, thick book this thick at home about the history of alcoholism, and boy, I'm telling you, read that stuff for a while, and you know what I'm talking about. Many things have been tried down through the centuries, and none of them ever worked till this program came along. This program works. Well, there's a way of doing it. And as I said before, I'm a fundamentalist in AA. There's a program that we present, and it's foolproof if we'll take it the way it's presented. And here's the way I do it. People hear about this freak of a guy down in Castleberry, Florida, that has some way of fixing drunks in 48 hours, taking them through this program, and they don't drink anymore. And they go home, they have a different life. And out of curiosity, other people hear about this and they inquire. So Grace and I get calls from all over this country. We don't get any from Orlando because people in Orlando think I'm nuts. They all know more about this than I do. See? They should. They're still drinking, most of them. But they really, it's the old saying in the Bible, a prophet is without honor in his own home, is so true. I go 50 miles away, I'm an authority. But down there, I'm a bum. So be it. I got used to that years ago. Well, anyway, these people call, and they want to get fixed. Some of them have been sober matters of years. Some of them have been in and out for matters of years and months and what have you. But they know they're not getting what they ought to be getting. There's something better because they see people around that are smiling and having a good time out of life, and they're not. They're miserable. And they're living on this white-knuckle sobriety. And so they want something. They call. Well, I qualify people. And if a person don't qualify, I can't do anything with them. So here's my qualification. And any of you folks who are going to do this, don't ever forget, this is the most important part of the whole thing, is qualify your prospect. This may sound ridiculous to a lot of people, because today anybody can walk into an AA meeting and sit down and attend the meeting and tell them he's an alcoholic or tell them nothing. They don't, in fact, the members won't even tell you their names anymore. This is how ridiculous this thing has gotten. So anybody can walk in. They couldn't do that in my day. Nobody could walk into an AA meeting where I came from. Somebody had to bring you. And they brought you when you were ready for it. They prepared you for this meeting. Big difference. That's why so many people, as you heard last night, Bill said that we had a record of better than 90% recovery. And I'll tell you how that was. I can prove that. Because when all this big push started, it all started in Cleveland. That publicity in the Cleveland Plain there was really what got AA off the, really on the road. All those inquiries came through me. And I'd hand them out to these men. I'd give you a whole handful on Monday morning and tell you to report to me, and Wednesday tell me what you did with them. And I'd give them to all the fellas around. And they did it just like a sales manager does, you know. They'd report this stuff. And they went out with gusto and chased these leads down. And there were hundreds of them, believe me. Well, when these people call me, I qualify them. Here's the qualification. First of all, I want to know this person's an alcoholic. I'm not interested in common drunks. Now, every alcoholic is a drunk, but every drunk is not an alcoholic. Don't ever forget that. There's an awful lot of people who drink a lot of booze that are not alcoholics. They don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. An alcoholic has something on the stick. They are remarkable people. Alcoholics are the ingenuity, the con, and the quick working up here. An alcoholic is not a deep thinker, but boy, he's a conniver, and he'll do something. Thinking or not, he isn't going to think about anything. You'll never find an alcoholic posing for the statue of Rodin's thinker. But you'll find an active bird, whatever he is, man or woman. And boy, they can lie, cheat, steal, defraud, and make you like it. Drunks can't do that. They don't have what it takes to be an alcoholic. To be an alcoholic, you're a breed of cats all your own. You're different than people. Believe me, alcoholics are different than people, and they all have the same characteristics in common. That's why we can get along the way we do, and that's the way we can fight successfully the way we do. Well, anyway, I must know this person's an alcoholic, he must admit it, and he must know it. This is first. That's important. I got to know this person's an alcoholic, and I can tell that by sharing with him and listening to him, and asking a few simple questions. Then I ask him what he wants to do about it. Well, he tells me he wants to quit. Well, that's great, Buster. Lots of people will quit if I'll quit for them. He don't like to listen to that. I'm not petting this bird. I'm tough. I have what they call tough love. You either take what I have or go jump. That's as simple as I can put it. I ain't going to pet anybody. This is going to mean your life, it's your future, and what's going to happen to you after this life. So if you don't like what I'm giving you, why, go sell your paper someplace else. I don't have time to fool with a bunch of dodos. So these people, the next thing I ask him, here's the important question. After he tells me he wants to quit, I said, all right, Buster, what are you willing to do to quit drinking forever? Boy, that shakes them up. That forever is a long time, because they've been going to these meetings and talking about 24 hours and all that crap. And I'm not interested in 24 hours or 24 months or 24 years. I'm interested in forever. What are you willing to do? Well, believe me, you'll get some funny answers on that one. But I only want one answer. And when he or she can give me the right answer, I'll let them come down. They have to tell me they're willing to do anything. I didn't make this up, kids. This is in our AA book. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Doesn't say you're ready before that. That's your qualification. I'm not out here wasting my breath on a lot of dodos that just want to have some sympathy. If a person wants his life changed, I know how he can get it changed, and I can direct him in that, put him into that direction. But he has to mean business. So he tells me that, okay, then we go into the steps. Now here's the way this thing works. Chapter 5, how it works. There are 200 well-chosen words in our AA 12-step program. 200 words, count them. If you will read them carefully, you will find that alcohol is mentioned once in that whole 200 words. And that's in the first part of the first step. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. Then it says something else that they miss entirely. And my life has become unmanageable. That's the part they don't hear. All they're thinking about is that alcohol, and they talk about alcohol the rest of their life and tell how drunk they got from 1909 to 1979, see? You hear all these drunkalogues, alcohol, booze. I want to hear something about getting your life changed, like Bill was talking about last night, and like Doug was talking about this morning. You hear people who are successful in this program, they're not talking about drunk, drink, alcohol. They're talking about getting their life straightened out. So it says that they're here to get their life changed. It's a life-changing program. So the first step says, I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. Well, how do I get my life manageable? This is what I want to do. If I'm an alcoholic, I got to make my life manageable. And I'm unable to do it. This is a sad part of it, because it tells you right off the bat that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, so I can't manage it. So what happens? I got to hire a manager. So the second step says, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. A power greater than myself. There's only one power greater than myself, and that's God. Eh? So I have to come to believe that God can restore me to sanity. That's what I have to come to believe. Now, if I'm talking to you, I ask you if you believe that God can take care of you and put you up and straighten you up and get your life in order. And if you believe in him, you'll say yes. All right. Then I'll introduce you to your new manager in step three. Any of you folks, there's some of you folks I'm going to work with tonight, and this is what's going to happen to you, you two kids. You're going to, step three, you're going to meet your new manager, and you're not going to walk up to him and shake your hands with him. You're going to get on your knees to him. That's the way you're going to meet him. That's when he's going to come to you. As long as you're so testy, you're not going to let him in. So you have your first act of humility on your knees, step three. In our original AA book, I have one of the ones at home before a lot of the words were changed, and that step three made you be on your knees. That's the way it was first written. But a lot of people have changed a lot of things in that book over the years. But that's one of the things they changed. So you go on your knees on step three, and you meet, and I introduce you to your new manager. And he accepts you like that. He's been waiting for you. He wants that job. So you hire him. So step four, see, step one and step three, people flounder on because they only hear alcohol in step one. They don't hear the other parts, so they miss the boat right off the bat for what they're going to do. And step three, step two, some of them worry about this God business, but I put that to rest right away because you're going to believe in him or not. And if you don't bother me because this is all I have to offer. You come to see what I want, what I have. You want what I have. I don't want what you have. You come, you want what I have. There it is. See? So this is what I have. If you don't like it, well, we're still friends, but don't bother me. Let me alone. I got other people that I have to give attention to. I'm not about to waste my breath and time on some dodo that's playing games, because another guy's waiting right here that wants what I have and is eager to take it. And I'm not going to waste time with a bunch of people that are blowing smoke. Good. That's just as tough as it is. So, you're introduced to your manager, step three. Step four is one that people really screw up on, in great shape. And women more than men. Girls as well as men come to our home. And invariably, I don't know why men don't do this as much as women, but women do. In every case, practically everyone that ever comes to my house, girls come with a sheaf of papers this thick that they have laboriously worked for hours and days writing every lousy, stinking thing they have ever done in their life. I don't, for the life of me, know how they remember all this garbage. But they write this stuff, it's like reading a sordid book, an X-rated movie. So they hand me this stuff for their step four, that they've worked so hard and laboriously and struggled over and cried over and what have you. And they hand it to me, and I look at it, and I throw it in the wastebasket, and they faint. I am not interested in the details of their transgressions. I'm not a bit interested in that crap. Their bed crawling and all this other stuff that goes with it. This don't interest me. I'm interested in what causes them to do these things. And that's what step four is all about. So in this step four, it says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Doesn't say anything about what you did. It's a moral inventory. What are you made of that causes you to do these things? So there's 20 questions there that I ask you. And they are questions such as resentments and hate and self-pity, dishonesty, and a lot of these. There's 20 of them. And as I call these questions off, the person will say, yeah, I am selfish, I am resentful, I am jealous, or I am envious, or what have you. Usually people have, out of those 20, the average person has 10 to 12 of those questions, those answers for those questions. They have 10 or 12 of these things they need to get rid of. I have only met one person in all my experience who had all 20 of them. I met a man. He came down here from up in Tennessee. And this man was a brilliant man. He's a man of letters, has a very important position. He's a big executive in a big manufacturing company up there, and he has everything that money can buy. And one of the most miserable people I ever met in my life. And this guy came down, and he was in AA for 11 years. And he was still dry. He had not drank in 11 years. White knuckle sobriety, fighting that booze deal. So we went through this fourth step, and he answered yes to every one of them. I said, "Brother, you're the worst screwed up bird I ever met in my life." And he admitted it. I had one girl come down one time from South Carolina. She had 19 of them. She was a star, but she didn't make a perfect record. But and we get letters from these people. Had a letter just recently from that girl in Carolina. She is the happiest person. She's happier than a dead pig in the sunshine. The first time in her life. But this man and all of these people, none of them drink anymore. They don't drink anymore. And they get a new life, and they have a new direction entirely in their life. They become different people. They become what happened one time to me. A very important thing happened to me one night. When I was still going to Oxford group meetings in Akron, I hadn't been going too long, and this old boy, Bill Van Horn, was a real drunk. He was a refugee from a nut factory. They had put him in the Maslin State Insane Asylum, his people did, just for his protection and the protection of the police departments and society in general. But he'd get drunk, and he was a disaster. So they just locked him up and threw a key away. But my sponsor got him out of there. Doc got him out and put him in the group, and he never had a drink to his dying day. And Bill was a great, big, rough, tough guy. And he took some kind of a liking to me for some reason or other. Strange things happen. And he'd always talk to me after meetings. And I'll never forget this because it had a great effect on the direction my life was taking. He used to get me behind T. Henry's library table down at Oxford group meeting after meetings and talk to me, and I couldn't get away from him. And I was half scared of this guy. He used to tower over me like a moose. And he was rough. And knowing that he came out of a booby hatch, I was not too comfortable being overawed by this guy. But he always talked to me, and so one night he said this to me. And this had a great effect on changing my whole life. And I'd like to share it with you. He said, "Clarence," he said, "and I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball of wax." He says, "I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. I don't want you to ever forget it." See, this is the way they made suggestions in those days. So Bill takes his billfold out and starts emptying it on T. Henry's library table. All kinds of debris come out of there, everything but money. Pictures and clippings out of paper, all kinds of crap. And it's piled up there. And finally he finds what he's looking for, and he hands it to me. It's a slip of paper. And I look at it, and I read it, and it's a Bible verse. And I look at that Bible verse, and I look at that big gorilla in front of me. I thought, yeah, maybe they did let this guy out too soon, you know, running around handing out stuff like this, you know. But I did what Bill told me to do. I read it, I memorized it, I never have forgotten it. It has had a marked effect on my chance of understanding things. It was one of my favorite verses. It was the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter and the 17th verse. And it reads this way, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." Get that. "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." This is what we're talking about in a new life. This is what Dick was talking about a while ago. Get into a new life. Become a new person, a new creature. Get rid of all that old garbage.